Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The River Thames sparkled in the late afternoon sunlight, rays striking the surface of the water amid white caps raised up by the occasional gusts of wind. Close to the banks, a stand of oaks rustled in the breeze. The tree's branches were full of leaves, sprouting in the relative heat of the early English summer of the year 1455. Little sound disturbed the quiet of the spot. Simple, undecorated wood and stone markers sheltered in the shade of the trees. Further away, back toward the imposing stone walls and tall spire of the new parish church, mounds of freshly turned earth marked the most recent graves. Many of them disturbed the open ground of the churchyard, all of them dug in the past few weeks. A summer plague had accompanied the turning of the weather towards something a touch more pleasant, a sudden fever followed by a quick death. The people of London suffered for it. The quiet tramping of feet broke the near silence of the placid scene. The parish priest led the procession, his white vestments swaying in the breeze as he walked. Behind him came a woman, perhaps 30 years old, clad all in the black of a mourning widow. Her name was Margaret, and her gait was steady and sure, her head held high, her eyes staring straight ahead. Two little girls, each no more than 5 years of age, walked on either side of her, clasping her hands. Tears streaked their faces, sadness warring for space with confusion and pain. A long train of people followed them. Prosperous, well-fed men with bellies straining against their fur-lined coats, accompanied by gaggles of wives and children. London's company of brewers looked after its own, even in death. Ahead waited two open graves side by side, one large and one small. The priest swayed a bit where he stood, still not recovered from the previous night's drinking, until he found his voice. "In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti," he began, his voice cracking. Too many of these, he thought, wishing for another drink to wash the taste of suffering from his mouth. Too many widows and widowers, orphan children, families shattered by some fresh wave of disease. The priest drank not because he was a bad man or an unfit shepherd for his flock, but because he was a good one. Why did God allow this, he wondered, as he ran through the funeral with an ease born of far too much practice. He wished he had better answers than the ones he so often gave to the mourners. When he couldn't answer to his own satisfaction, as he usually couldn't, the drink helped. If these questions troubled the widow, she didn't show it. Margaret remained stoic, keeping a gentle but firm grasp on the two little girls' hands. She didn't crack until the two little girls left in the company of the brewers, leaving the priest and the widow behind. Tears streamed down her face when the grave diggers lowered two shrouded corpses, one quite large and one very small, into the graves. The priest put his hand on her shoulder for comfort, but she shrugged him off. She was burying a husband and a son. Nothing the priest could say would soften that blow. Margaret watched as the gravediggers shoveled dirt into the graves. She stayed until they were done, then the priest and the diggers left her alone. Finally, the sun started to dip down behind the oaks along the riverbank, leaving the churchyard shrouded in early evening darkness. Only then did the widow wipe away her tears and turn away. The sun had set tonight, and it would rise tomorrow. Her girls would rise with the dawn. The apprentices would need to be fed and set to work picking up supplies and brewing to meet the outstanding orders. With her husband's death, she was now the face of their business, a full member of the Brewers Guild. Trade waited on no tragedy. Life went on. For her girls and for herself, Margaret meant to keep on living. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. One of the central methods of this show is using real people or composite characters to illustrate the major trends of an era. In essence, we're wrapping a theme or historical process around the life of a person to give it some narrative scaffolding. This is structurally useful for me as a writer. Writing is mostly about structure. And it's useful for you, the listener, in a few different ways. First, it drives home one of this show's central points, that big things, history-shaping things, affect individual people in meaningful ways. Second, focusing on people gives the world some texture. It makes it real in a way that dry accounts looking down from great heights, abstract heights, can't really provide. Finally, and most important, it's interesting and enjoyable to experience the life of another person, to step into their shoes and maybe feel what they felt or see what they saw. That's one of the great benefits of history, that it helps us step outside ourselves and get some perspective. But for the most part, I approach these characters in an instrumental sense. They're useful tools for telling a story about major historical themes and processes and events, for placing you, the listener, in a world that feels a little bit more real. For our next couple of episodes, I want to try something a little different. Instead of starting with the theme or big thing and then finding the person, I want to reverse the process. Let's imagine a person, a composite character, and place them in a real time and place and try to understand their story in an organic sense. In other words, let's allow the themes and processes and events to flow out of this hypothetical person's life, out of their narrative, instead of vice versa. This means that on the spectrum from hard history to historical fiction, this might have a little bit more in common with historical fiction than our usual endeavors. I'm comfortable with that, and I hope that you'll stick with me too. One note here. For everything that follows, I'm drawing heavily on Judith Bennett's book, Ale, Beer, and Brewsters in England. I chatted with Judith on Tides last year. She's one of my very favorite people in the world, and it's a wonderfully accessible book if you're interested in the topic. So let's meet, or rather reacquaint ourselves, with our subject for this week. Her name is Margaret, and she's the widow we encountered by the graveside. Perhaps it's not fair to meet someone on their worst day, but death and loss were key parts of what it meant to be alive in the 15th century. Mortality was a fact of life. Medieval people felt that keenly, never more so than in the age that followed the Black Death. Time on Earth was just a brief and transient stage in a soul's journey. There was a good reason the question of salvation weighed so heavily on medieval Christians. Heaven and hell figured to be much longer-term residences. The basic fact of high mortality shaped and conditioned lives, social mores, and ways of life for all medieval people. It shaped marriage, inheritance, business practices, forms of religious devotion, art, philanthropy, urban planning, and practically everything else you can imagine. In trying to understand Margaret's world and her life, it makes sense to start with death. Margaret was 30 years old when her husband and son died in 1455. The Hundred Years' War had ended in ignominious defeat for England after more than a century of involvement on the continent. Elsewhere in England, the long-running civil war that would eventually become known as the Wars of the Roses had just begun a few weeks prior in the city of St. Albans. Margaret had heard of this event in garbled terms, but it mattered little to her or her fellow brewers. In the German city of Mainz, some 500 miles away on the continent, a goldsmith named Johannes Gutenberg had recently invented the printing press. 2 years prior, the Ottomans had finally succeeded in capturing Constantinople, battering down its thousand-year walls with some of the new and terrifying gunpowder cannon. A Wallachian prince named Vlad Tepes would soon make a name for himself by impaling his political adversaries by the score. These were the events of the age. Some of them bore directly on Margaret's life, but most didn't. The forces that shaped her existence were far less dramatic, more quotidian, less obvious. Epidemic disease, as Margaret knew to her sorrow, was a frequent occurrence. Fevers, chills, sharp bouts of sickness that arrived and carried off whole families and communities without warning or understanding. The worst of these visitors was the dreaded plague, Yersinia pestis, the bacterium that caused the Black Death a century before and periodically returned to wreak havoc. In fact, though it wasn't the disease that killed her son and husband, Yersinia pestis shaped Margaret's entire life. Plague laid down some of the structural foundations of her world long before she was born, and continued to guide it and mold it throughout her days. How, you might ask? Demography. The world before the plague was largely defined by rising population. As we talked about a couple of months ago, this was at the core of the Commercial Revolution. The European economy expanded dramatically between about 1100 and 1300. More trade, more use of money, more markets, both literal and figurative, and so on. Rising populations, more people, lay at the heart of this. More people meant more production, more land under cultivation, and more surplus for elites to tap and turn into demand for luxuries and other goods. Long-distance trade helped spur shorter-distance commerce, eventually driving market activities deep down into the countryside. But by about 1300, that population growth had reached its limits. Practically all the usable land in Western Europe was under cultivation. Lots of marginal land, rocky hillsides and swampy lowlands, for example, had come into use for grain, the crop that could feed the greatest number of people per acre. The corollary was the demand for land was extremely high, lots of people didn't have land, and labor was cheap and plentiful. This meant that the balance of power between landlords and tenants, employers and employees, was heavily weighted in favor of the elite. The plague changed that balance. Now, this didn't happen on its own. If we followed the historian Bruce Campbell's argument in The Great Transition, then a less stable and worsening climate combined with war, and especially disease, to dramatically shift the demographic baseline. The Black Death killed somewhere between a third and half, and in some places more, of Europe's population between 1347 and 1353. Now, normally, in the aftermath of an epidemic or another mass mortality event, population tends to rebound quickly. With lots of land and resources available, people tend to marry younger and have more children. Numbers rise pretty fast. But that didn't happen after the Black Death for a few reasons. Worsening climatic conditions drove crop yields down, for one thing. Endemic war and the violence that went along with it disrupted trade and killed still more people. Most of all, plague returned again and again. The wave that struck across the continent in 1360 to 1363 was particularly devastating to children born since the first outbreak. After that, it came back over and over. All of this produced a basic shift in mortality. Average life expectancy, taking into account extremely high infant death rates, had been around 25 before the plague. It fell to 20 afterward. This was the essence of what demographers call a high mortality regime. Population dropped and then stayed low for generations after the plague. In England, for example, they didn't really start to tick upward again until after 1500 or so. Instead of being a blip, key conditions fundamentally changed. These shifts produced the material backbone of Margaret's world. Cheaper land, more economic opportunity for non-elites, less social leverage for elites in the countryside, and so on. So again, Margaret's life began to take shape long before she was born. If we want to understand Margaret, we have to understand her circumstances and her family's deep history, how it fit into this changing context. Her grandmother was born in 1365 in Essex, some 40 miles northeast of London, in a village that sat in the shadow of a long-ruined timber castle. This woman's name was Agnes, and she was the daughter of a free tenant of a manor owned by the Earl of Oxford, a member of the De Vere family. The Black Death hit this part of Essex hard. The survivors were forever haunted by what they'd lost, but that didn't stop Agnes's father from exploiting the opportunities the plague had created. He had begun his life as a landless, if at least not enserfed, wage laborer, working for a pittance and living in a drafty hut crowded with his family and siblings. But with land cheap and available, he was able to lease a few unconnected plots from the Earl's manor and build a prosperous, small-scale life as an independent farmer. His daughter Agnes benefited from that slow, precarious rise up the social scale. She married the son of another local smallholder who added to the precious bits of land his father had left him. Agnes and her husband made a reasonably well-off life in the Essex countryside. They owned 5 acres of good arable outright and leased another 10 from the Earl of Oxford, land they used for grain. Alternating rises and dips, long, straight ridges and furrows, and the fields marked the passage of the plow a bit deeper every year. Every day, Agnes's husband walked out to one of these plots of land, bringing one or two of his sons and hired laborers to work the land. Sometimes they tended their livestock, cattle and a few sheep and pigs, that lived in an enclosed pasture behind their thatched-roofed house on the edge of the village. Agnes spent much of her spare time brewing ale in a small, dedicated brew house right next to the pasture. It was enough to provide ale for the whole family, and the cash earned from selling the surplus often went to pay lease fees or fines in the local manorial court. Five children, three boys and two girls, plus four more who didn't survive infancy, crowded into that house. The youngest was their daughter Cecilia, born in 1398. This was Margaret's mother. Despite the family's increased standard of living, enough to invest in those livestock and the occasional bit of nice pottery, a longbow and time to practice for one of the boys, young Cecilia was not destined for a life of leisured prosperity. Her older sister had gotten a large enough dowry to marry the son of an upwardly mobile yeoman with 25 acres of land and a few hundred head of sheep. The eldest brother stuck around, marrying the daughter of another middling family. The middle son went to France with his longbow in the service of King Henry V in 1415 and made a life as a professional soldier, surviving the Battle of Agincourt and living out the rest of his days in Normandy. The youngest boy, closest in age to Cecilia, learned to read and write and became a parish priest in the next village over. Yet after paying for the longbow and the Latin schooling and her elder sister's dowry, there wasn't much left over for young Cecilia. The pittance of a dowry her family could provide would not attract a suitor on their social level. Cecilia would have to make her own way in the world. Luckily for her, Cecilia had options. London was just 40 miles down the road, and her brother-in-law, her sister's husband's brother, had moved to the city, where he was working his way up as a lawyer at the Inns of Court. There was an opening for a servant in his growing household if Cecilia was willing to move to the city. She was. There was no social disrepute in a young person of either gender working as a servant. It was understood to be a normal stage in life, where a young man or woman could work for a few years and accumulate resources and knowledge before moving on to marriage, children, and profession. In 1417, age 19, Cecilia hitched a ride on a neighbor's cart with a few meager possessions and left Essex and her family behind. Waiting at the end of Cecilia's bumpy ride down rutted, sunken lanes was her new employer's house, a prosperous, half-timbered home on the outskirts of London. London was the center of England in every way, political, social, cultural, and economic. It would be her and her descendants' home, the place they would make their lives and deaths.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cecilia's life in her new home was one of constant motion. London bustled with activity. Lawyers like her brother-in-law with their entourages of clerks and employees, rattling carts loaded down with wool from the countryside, destined first for the docks and then for buyers in Calais and the Low Countries beyond, scarred, swaggering longbowmen and men-at-arms home from Normandy and the campaigns in France, richly dressed clerics heading through the streets on regular processions and some half-known saint's feast day, brewers hefting sacks of grain and malt and casks of finished ale. One of these brewers, a recently graduated journeyman named Richard, chatted up Cecilia on a fine early fall day in 1422. She was buying ale and other necessities for the household, thinking about the recent news of King Henry V's untimely death, and they struck up a conversation, as unattached people do. Cecilia knew ale and brewing. Like most peasant women, her mother had brewed, and Cecilia was familiar with the process, the product, and the business. Richard liked her immediately, and before long, he was finding reasons to go to her employer's neighborhood. She liked him, too, a sharp, hard-working recent arrival from Cambridgeshire, and that was enough. They married in 1423, she aged 26, him close to 30. She moved out of her employer's house, and they began their lives together. Now, that might seem a bit old, given our stereotypes of child brides in the past, but it really wasn't unusual for England in the 15th century. In fact, most of northwestern Europe, England, northern Germany, the Low Countries, and Scandinavia, shared a striking pattern of surprisingly late marriage for women. It even has a name, the European marriage pattern. This trend toward later marriage for women began in the late Middle Ages and extended well into the early modern period. One historian, Mary Hartman, followed by a number of others, has argued that this marriage pattern lay at the root of the so-called Little Divergence, the shocking rise of northwestern European economies and states in the early modern period. Later marriage meant a great deal more freedom for women, more agency, that they brought more economic assets into the marriage, they had fewer children, and generally experienced more autonomy than women in Central, Southern, or Eastern Europe, or most of the world beyond that. The implications of all this matter a great deal. The household was the fundamental unit of society, and northwestern European households focused around small nuclear families with more equal partners. This marked a distinct difference from the rest of the continent. It's possible to take this too far, of course. It's all relative. There was no utopia of medieval or early modern gender equality. This was still a deeply patriarchal society, and women were legally, socially, and culturally constrained in a vast number of ways. But degrees of equality matter a great deal. The difference between, say, Italy and England in this period is striking. The daughter of a Florentine artisan might marry a 30-year-old man at age 16, while Cecilia married her husband at age 26. That's a huge gap. When you repeat that millions of times across society, you're going to get some major, large-scale differences. To get a sense for that difference, listen to this poem by the Dutch schoolteacher Anna Beens, a couple of generations after Margaret lived. Maidens and wenches, remember the lesson you're about to hear. Don't hurdle yourself into marriage far too soon. The saying goes, where is your spouse? Where's your honor? But one who earns her board and clothes shouldn't scurry to suffer a man's rod. Happy the woman without a man. Even if Beans' sentiment was on the more extreme end of the spectrum, the underlying attitude was common. Late marriage was the norm, never marrying was a bit frowned upon but still perfectly acceptable, and women on the whole benefited from it. For Cecilia and her soon-to-be-born eldest daughter, Margaret, the implications wound themselves into their daily lives. Cecilia purchased her own marriage certificate. She had saved her wages for years, building enough of a nest egg that she and Richard could purchase a combined home and modest brew house and buy his entry into the company of brewers as a master. In short, late marriage helped make Cecilia and Richard's young household far more viable. It set them up for a combined trip, slowly and tentatively, toward prosperity. Margaret arrived shortly after Richard and Cecilia set off on their own. If it seems odd to you that our main character only appears halfway through the second act, well, I understand, but there's a good reason for this. Nobody arrives in the world free and clear. Even before we're born, our circumstances shape our potential futures. That's true today, and it was true for Margaret. If it hadn't been for the Black Death, her ancestors wouldn't have accumulated enough land and opportunity for Cecilia's sister to marry an upwardly mobile local, giving her the connections to move to London for a shot at a better life, and so on. We have to understand that collective past to understand Margaret and her world. The household in which Margaret grew up was a busy, crowded, and happy one. Like Cecilia, Richard had come to the city from elsewhere. In his case, he had grown up in the swampy fens of Cambridgeshire, on the island of Ely. He told little Margaret captivating stories of pulling enormous eels out of cleverly built traps from the deck of his uncle's little boat, the way the flocks of swamp-dwelling birds looked silhouetted against the sun rising over the fens when they took flight, the slimy chill that came from the particular brand of wet, icy cold that marked the winter in Ely. Like Cecilia, Richard had also been the youngest child in his family. His father was a respectable potter, but the family's kilns would pass to his elder brother, not him. And so Richard had come to London, where a cousin had worked his way into the brewer's company, and the lad from Cambridge became a brewer's apprentice. Brewers and potters were both artisans, and the basics of running an artisanal operation were roughly similar. Early in childhood, Richard had learned to read, write, and keep basic accounts. There had constantly been apprentices and employees running around the workshops, loading and unloading the boats that pulled right up to the quay at the back of the shop to drop off clay and fuel for the kilns and pick up finished wares. The combined home and brew house he and Cecilia kept was similar in its rhythms. Raw materials, water and malt and yeast coming in, ale and occasionally hopped beer going out. They dealt in short-term credit when their buyers were a bit short of cash, as they often were, and did the same with their suppliers. Employees and apprentices had to be looked after and paid. Nobody was going to confuse this operation with the Medici Bank, growing to prominence under the leadership of Cosimo de' Medici at precisely this time, but Cecilia and Richard ran a relatively sophisticated workshop. This was the environment that shaped Little Margaret, a commercial brewing operation on a reasonably prosperous scale. From the time she could walk, Margaret was following around Richard and Cecilia, watching them prepare, brew, sell, and handle all the other activities that went along with running a business. Early on, Richard and Cecilia forged connections to the royal household and often sent the bulk of their ale production to supply the enormous coterie of courtiers, stable boys, staff, and assorted hangers-on who clustered around the infant King Henry VI. They sold to alehouses, taverns, inns, noble households, and other large buyers, but nobody beat the royals. Brewing for the royal household was one of the most lucrative pieces of business for London's brewers. Even in the center of England, the kingdom's commercial, political, social, and cultural capital, the royal household was still a uniquely profitable and reliable buyer. It was also a buyer dominated by the Company of Brewers, or Brewers Guild, the organization to which Richard, Cecilia, and their peers all belonged. Everybody drank ale, from adolescents to the elderly. Men, women, children, the poorest of the poor and the richest of the rich. Quality varied, naturally, with landed nobles generally consuming a better ale than their tenants and rich international merchants quaffing a superior beverage as compared to sailors. Regardless, outside of bread, it was the most widely consumed good in England. This meant that there was tremendous demand for it, which required an enormous supply. Out in the countryside, where grain was easily available, practically everyone brewed. They drank most themselves within the household and bartered or sold the remainder for other necessities. Our friend Cecilia, of course, had grown up in a rural home with a mother who brewed regularly. The process of making ale was well known and understood, part of the texture and fabric of life for everybody. It was mostly women's work, a relatively low-status trade carried out on the margins. In London, regular folks, again, almost all women, still brewed for themselves in small-time sales, but they weren't the only ones. The city was the most commercialized place in the kingdom, one of the most commercialized in Europe, and the structure of the brewing industry reflected that. Where there was money to be made, a lot of it, in any place in the medieval world, an organization would spring up to regulate and, if possible, monopolize that trade. In London, that organization was the Brewers Guild, or the Company of Brewers. By paying an entry fee, supplying annual dues, and participating in the rich social life of the guild, brewers received legal protection and privileges built around their trade. The Brewers Guild was well established in London by the time Margaret came into the world in 1425, and were fortunate enough to have a large quantity of their records from precisely this period. Those records allow us to understand just who was in the guild and precisely what they did a lot better than most of London's trade organizations at this time. Unlike the craft of brewing as a whole, which was mostly women's work, men dominated the Brewers Guild. Probably 2/3 of its members were men around the time of Margaret's birth, though there's some wiggle room in either direction. Still, that was a shockingly high female membership for a 15th century London craft guild. Most, like the grocers, the coopers, and the weavers, admitted no female members at all. And even that 2/3 male number is misleading. A lot of the individually listed male members actually represented a conjugal business for guild purposes, and their wives paid full members' dues on an annual basis. Cecilia wasn't listed on the guild rolls, but she still paid her annual fee and participated fully in most of the guild's activities. Again, this was not a world of egalitarian gender relations. The whole husbands but not wives being listed on the guild rolls things should point to that. But it's notable how much more open brewing was to women than most occupations at the time. Even in its lucrative commercialized form, the form Cecilia and Richard and Margaret all participated in, it benefited from the bleed over of brewing being considered women's work. These expectations and norms around gender, work, and women's roles shaped little Margaret's life in profound ways. She grew up in an industry full of working women in meaningful social and economic roles. Her mother, Cecilia, handled large chunks of the family's brewing business, and she and Richard handled the many tasks that went along with brewing according to their individual strengths. Richard was pleasant, slow to anger, and good with figures, so he handled the accounts, sales, and shipments across the muddy lanes and crowded waterways of the city. Cecilia understood the intricacies of brewing itself and didn't mind riding herd on the apprentices and employees. They made good ale, and a lot of it, and their products sold well across the city. Before long, Richard took on administrative responsibilities in the guild and started to dabble in low-level politics. He, Cecilia, and Margaret prospered, and their daughter absorbed everything her parents had to teach her about the business of brewing. She learned to read and write, and how to keep accounts from her father, and how to manage the apprentices and the actual process of brewing. By the time she was 15, her parents trusted Margaret to oversee some batches of ale production and deal with suppliers. Surly employees underestimated the girl at their peril. But despite Richard and Cecilia's best efforts, Margaret remained an only child. None of the three siblings who followed her survived past infancy, an all too common occurrence. London was especially prone to outbreaks of illness. Travelers and merchants arrived in the city regularly, bringing disease with them, while malaria was common in the low-lying and often swampy southeast of England. Pre-modern cities were, by their nature, death traps. Their populations were only replenished by constant immigration from the countryside, just as Richard and Cecilia had arrived in the city. London was no exception, well into the 19th century. Being an only child, Margaret was set to inherit the family's brewing operation when her parents died. As she grew to adulthood, this made her a sought-after marriage prospect in the pragmatic, close-knit world of the brewers. These people associated with each other constantly. They did business together, shared suppliers, loaned each other money, attended meetings, politicked, threw parties and festivals, and generally made a miniature social and economic world. It was only to be expected that Cecilia and Richard's child, for that is what Margaret was as much as an individual in her own right, would be expected to marry a brewer as well. She expected it too, for that matter. This might have turned out poorly, and marriages of this sort were often rocky or unhappy, but Margaret was fortunate. John Fuller, her husband-to-be, was known to be honest, hardworking, and kind. Most of all, he had the good sense to trust his new wife in their joint business.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Strains of music floated through the Brewers' Guild Hall. The wooden floors creaked under the weight of dancing, reeling, laughing, and smiling revelers, many of them dressed in the distinctive livery of the brewers, the greater brewers in their gowns and the lesser in their hoods. Roast beef and whole chickens and loaves of bread and cheeses and apples disappeared into the bellies of the attendees, washed down with copious amounts of the finest ales London's most prominent brewers could produce. Weddings, like that of Margaret and John Fuller, were occasions for revelry among people who knew how to have a good time. Drums thumped and lutes were plucked, feet stomped on the floor in rhythm, voices rose and fell in incessant singing and chatter and laughter, interrupted only by the occasional crunch of a ceramic mug or dish breaking. A bit of broken crockery was to be expected, given the quantities of ale traveling down the well-practiced gullets of the brewers and their associates. Many enjoyed their own product, some a bit too much, judging by the red noses, slurred words, and broken blood vessels that marked more than a few of the faces sweating in the warmth of an early summer evening. Cecilia and Richard, proudly clad in his expensive velvet brewer's gown, chatted away animatedly with John Fuller's father, John Fuller the Elder. Young John's mother had passed away some years before. All in attendance agreed that the Fullers were fine people, honest, they made good on their debts, and they made a particularly fine quality of ale. When Margaret looked at her new husband, she saw a man approaching 30, his blonde hair thinning a bit, with a plain, open face and a propensity for a wide, gap-toothed smile. He reminded her of her father, slow to anger, good with people, organized, and she looked forward to their new life together. 1448 would be the start of something good for her and John, she thought. Margaret's dowry was substantial, and it provided enough working capital for the new couple to set up their own household and brew house. Margaret and John paid their dues to the Brewers Guild as a married couple, 2 shillings per year. And behind the scenes, Margaret ran most of their joint business. She kept most of the books, she procured apprentices and employees, she oversaw brewing, and she often met with the buyers. It was her dowry, her capital, and for the most part, John treated it like her business. Again, in the late 1440s, brewing was still an industry dominated numerically and in total volume by women, and Margaret handled things much as her mother, Cecilia, had done. Yet John was the public face of their business and the one active in the Brewers Guild. For all the better opportunities that the brewing industry offered to women compared to most of what was available, it was not a paradise of gender equality. Women could join the guild either on their own or as part of a married couple, like Margaret and Cecilia before her, but men were the ones whose guild membership made them full citizens of London. Just living in a place wasn't enough to grant a person the full rights and opportunities available. To have the freedom of the city, as it was called, meant the ability to own property, trade freely, and fully participate in the life of a craft organization like the Brewers. Wearing the livery, participating in processions, and generally being considered a real member of the community, well, that was only open to men. Margaret, for all of her talent and skill as a brewer and a business person, was barred from those opportunities. She couldn't hold office in the guild or participate in public processions like her husband, the male brewers, and the members of the city's other craft guilds. All medieval cities, but London in particular, were less monolithic units than patchworks of social and occupational groups. Only full members of the city's craft guilds, all of them men, were able to participate in the ceremonies and processions that made up the lifeblood of London's civic life. The city was a vibrant place full of diversity and activity and people from all walks of life. But it really belonged to its stakeholders. Respectable, prosperous, well-heeled men who appeared publicly in the distinctive livery, the costume of their guild. In a basic sense, identity for late medieval people was less a matter of the individual than group membership, and the ability to publicly display that membership was key. That's why the livery, the gowns and the hoods, mattered so much. A very few female brewers wore them, but it was almost entirely men, and it was entirely men who were able to publicly claim the identity of brewers with everything that went along with it. This troubled Margaret, an exceedingly competent brewer in her own right, but it was simply the way things worked. Her mother, Cecilia, had been bound by the same kinds of restrictions, but nobody doubted her importance to the business. The same went for Margaret, and that was all she could hope for. As the brewing business went well, she took on more and more responsibility. John started to focus more on importing ingredients in bulk to sell to other brewers. Yet still, John remained the public face of the business, the one who wore the livery, the one who appeared in the processions, and the one who attended to guild business. 3 children arrived in rapid succession, first 2 girls and then a boy, filling Margaret and John's home with the sound of crying, laughing, and the patter of little feet on the creaking wooden floors. Yet motherhood didn't come to define Margaret. She continued running the business, and as soon as her girls were old enough, she brought them along with her, just as Cecilia had done with her decades before. The boy was still too little to participate as Margaret approached her 30th birthday, just being weaned, and he spent most of his time with a servant at home. The family prospered. John's father died, leaving his brew house to John since he was the eldest son, and Margaret took over the management of that in addition to what she and John had begun together. Her parents were still hale and hearty for now, and running mostly the same operation they had in Margaret's childhood, but the expectation was that she would take that over as well when they died. She and John took on more apprentices and employees. They supplied the household of the Duke of York and the royal court, religious confraternities, the festivals of the city's other craft guilds, innumerable taverns and inns, and started to dabble not only in ale, but also the newfangled beer, made with imported hops as a preservative. It was growing a bit in popularity. They bought the house next door to their original property and expanded, adding outbuildings and storehouses, stables, and more. At the beginning of June, 1455, Margaret and John attended a gathering at the Brewer's Guildhall. It had rained the night before, the kind of gentle wash that defined the early summer, and John took care not to get mud on his fine velvet brewer's gown as they walked through the streets. When they arrived home, he had a gift for her, a finely illuminated Book of Hours, a devotional text full of Bible passages, psalms, and prayers. John had it copied and illustrated for her, an aid to her daily prayers and confessions to their drunkard of a local parish priest. The next day, Margaret awoke at dawn, got the girls ready for the day, and set about inspecting some repairs to the facilities at what had been her father-in-law's brew house. John wasn't feeling well. Too much ale at the Guildhall the night before, he thought, and so he stayed in bed. But by the time Margaret returned home that afternoon, John was dead. So was their little boy. A sudden fever had taken them both, the servants told her. It was the kind of unexplained, unexplainable loss that defined an era of high mortality. There was nothing to do but bury them. The funeral followed 2 days later. With John's death, Margaret controlled the entire brewing operation. The expanded ale and beer production that had begun with her dowry, her father-in-law's brewhouse, and John's investment in supply from the countryside. This made her one of the richest and most prominent brewers in the city, a status she would have traded in a heartbeat to have John and her little boy back. It also made her a sought-after target for remarriage. It might seem a bit crass to focus on questions of property, but they are essential to understanding marriage in the Middle Ages. Marriage was largely about assets, their protection, and how they were transferred from generation to generation. Remember, Margaret's dowry when she married John had provided the ready capital to start their joint brewing operation. According to the historian Barbara Hanawalt in her great book, The Wealth of Wives, marriage was the major conduit for capital formation, the capital formation that made London a serious financial and commercial hub in precisely this period. Margaret's life was a microcosm of this situation in London. Margaret was not interested in remarriage, no matter how hard widowed or unmarried master brewers tried to convince her that they would respect her and take her seriously. She had loved John and was perfectly confident in her ability to run her operation herself, even grow it. The fact that she couldn't participate fully in the life of the Brewers Guild rankled, even more now than it had before, but she continued to pay her dues. She insisted on buying her own set of livery, even if her ability to wear it publicly would be limited. Her daughters grew into adolescence, watching their mother consolidate her business, take over her parents' operation when they sadly passed on, and expand further into supply. Yet as Margaret prospered and aged, acquiring new lines on her face, a slight limp from a fall, and streaks of gray in her hair, the brewing industry was getting harder for women. Oh, the Brewers Guild prospered. The livery got fancier, the organization rose in the city's ranks, and they added new members. Margaret's growth was, if not exactly typical, then still normal. Brewing was increasingly capital-intensive, increasingly commercial, increasingly large-scale. Margaret had the assets and the savvy to exploit that. But most of the women who had previously brewed on the margins of the industry did not. The single women and independent widows who had made up much of the guild's membership in Margaret's childhood were slipping away, replaced more and more by men. the female-dominated brewing scene was changing. Margaret's daughters would not have the same freedom within the industry that she or her mother had had, or whose dying opportunities Margaret had been able to exploit both before and after John's death. As her daughters came of age and it came time to start planning their futures, Margaret tried to find them husbands who would treat them as John had done her, allowing them to run the brew houses they would inherit as they saw fit. It was getting harder and harder. The best she could do, she decided, was to set them up with sizable dowries and pray for the best. One found a wool merchant's son, a member of the Staplers, a merchant guild, and continued brewing using her husband as the business's public face. The other married a brewer, who forced her out of active management as soon as he was able. The times had changed. Even as the brewing industry expanded and professionalized, became more lucrative, and the brewers rose in the estimation of the city of London, they increasingly cut out the women who had been its lifeblood for so long. I hope this was a fun change of pace. It certainly was for me, and we'll try it again next time, when we follow a German artisan-turned-mercenary through the upheavals of the late 15th century. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides, or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.